I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. Welcome to 2017. It's finally here. Let's hope it's a better year than last year. And my first guest for the year is engineer Tim Latham. So first of all, I don't know if you've heard about Mozart being number one in album sales in 2016. There was a lot of hype about this, and it was all over the major news sources. The problem is, it's wrong. And basically the way the news sites and newspapers and anybody who picked this up, the way they figured this out was there were 6,250 box sets of Mozart that was sold in 2016. And this was a huge box set, 200 CDs. So if you multiplied 200 CDs by 6,250, that came out to 1.25 million CDs, which was more than anybody else. The problem is the story was wrong, because box sets are not counted as CD sales, or at least individual CD sales. And then, on top of it, only about 300 of those 6,250 were actually sold in the United States. The winner last year was Drake, with 4 million sales, but it's not the way it sounds. Only 300,000 of those 4 million were physical CDs. 1.2 million were digital album sales, and there were 5 million digital singles. But what's most astonishing is that Drake had 2.8 billion audio streams. And when you put all of that together, the way the new Billboard Nielsen charts figure this out, it came out to around 4 million sales, or the equivalent of 4 million album sales. So I don't know if I agree with the way they figure these things out. That being said, it's better than the way it used to be, but don't believe everything you read, and especially Mozart being number one, because it wasn't the case. As cool of a story as that sounds. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget about my new music producer formula course, as well as my other online video courses at bobbyosinskicourses.com. For more on my music industry and music production blogs, you can go to bobbyosinski.com to find the links, and you can also read excerpts from my books there. The next thing is, last week I wrote something on my blog that actually got a lot of response, and it was a music tech report card for 2016. A lot of people didn't agree with me, and I know a lot of people that listen to this podcast don't read the blog, so I'm going to go over it today, and maybe you'll understand why I came to these decisions, and hopefully you'll agree, and if not, let me know, because I'm open to any kind of interpretations that you might have as well. The first one was Apple, and I gave Apple a grade of D+ for last year. And the reason why was there was no new Mac Pro. All of us are still using either old Mac Pros, we're using iMacs, we're using the old trash cans from 2013, but there's nothing new to replace that or to update that. And let's face it, pros want to buy something new, and Apple just isn't giving it to us. The whole thing is, they seem to be fixated on iPhones these days, which makes a whole lot more money for them. But on the other hand, Apple was built on the backs of creatives like us, and they're not catering to us now. So I gave them a grade of D+. Another big company was Avid. And depending on which market that you're in, if you're in post-production, you look at Avid one way. If you're in music, you look at Avid another way. Basically, what Avid is doing is they're playing to their stockholders and not so much to their users. So, as many of you Pro Tools users know, it's time to pay up for the yearly subscription, and let's face it, a lot of us don't like that. So I gave Avid a grade of C-. They are making strides with Pro Tools. There's new features, but you know, a lot of those new features were on other DAWs for years and years, and Pro Tools just catching up now. Now, speaking of DAWs, digital audio workstations are definitely getting more and more sophisticated, and really the differences between them are blurring. That being said, most of them concentrate on music creation, and very few of them look at post-production. And as a result, that really means that Pro Tools is still the king of the hill when it really comes down to it. Now, what I predict is that people are going to change in a flash. So if there was a new workstation that came out that suddenly caught everybody's imagination and was really good and was really at a professional level, I think you see a lot of people jump from Avid. So I give digital audio workstations in general a grade of a B because, again, they are getting more sophisticated. They're getting better. There's a lot of great new features. And even the cheapest DAW is really good these days. Now, one category that I did give an A to was plugins. And plugins really reached a new level this year with new generation plugs that are very automated in that the process that engineers really took a lot of time is now kind of done for you. Isotope Neutron is a big one that does almost automatic EQing. It's not quite that simple, but that's the gist of it. Soundwaves Reveal and Low Leveler are two others that are very much in that category. And we're starting to see more and more of these next generation plugins coming in. There are many engineers that I'm not sure if they feel threatened, but they don't really like these next generation plugs. However, I think it's a good thing, and I give them a grade of an A. The other thing that gets an A are microphone modelers, and these new modeled microphones are really coming out pretty good. Slate VMS and the Townsend Lab Sphere, they're great alternatives to buying a classic microphone, and I think we're going to have more and more really big users start to use them. And we're going to see them more and more in the project studio even because they're pretty affordable and they really do the job. Another A goes to amplifier emulators. And once again, these are getting so good that my prediction is pretty soon people are going to kind of lose interest in real amplifiers. And this may be sacrilege to some people, but I'm seeing more and more really great guitar players coming to sessions with just a Matrix, for instance. And these are guys that have huge amp collections and they're not bringing them anymore. Or going on the road with them for that matter. And of course, with in-ear monitors, you no longer have to push air off the stage. So I predict in about 10 years, the next generation of guitar players are going to look back at guitar amplifiers and go, it doesn't sound as good as my whatever box they have that is the norm at the time. And we're seeing two, in fact, that are really leading the pack here, the Line 6 Matrix and the Blue Guitar Amp 1, which just came out that looks pretty amazing. Tablets get a grade of C, and for the most part, people have looked at tablets as a replacement for the computer. That's never worked for me. Tablets are a great output device. They're not a great input device. They work really wonderfully for certain applications, but dedicated applications. But for me, I don't see them as a replacement for the computer at all. The possibilities just haven't materialized the way I think they were envisioned. And that said, Avid's dock does a really good job of making use of what a tablet is really good at. So tablets get a grade of C. Smartphones get a grade of B. Again, it's a huge amount of computing power in the palm of your hand. I appreciate that. But I still think it's a flawed device. It's a lot slower, and this is even online. I don't understand how people can actually sit around waiting all day for their smartphone to catch up with them. It's way too slow for me. That being said, it does do a good job in the few pro applications that it really does shine. For instance, as a tuner, works great. BPM calculator works great. A remote control for cue mix. Those things like that, a smartphone is really dynamite. That being said, I'm not so sure that it's really going to replace anything, but it's a nice adjunct. Grade of B for smartphones. And finally, virtual reality. Everybody thought that VR was going to be especially big at Christmas, but it didn't take off the way everyone anticipated. There's a huge number of tools that are being developed for this, both on the audio and the visual side of things, much more so than the beginning of surround sound, which I remember started to get big and we didn't have the tools at the time. But now it's kind of reversed, where there's lots of tools, but we don't have the applications yet. We don't have the killer app. We don't have the killer program that's come out on VR. But that being said, I think there's going to be a lot of new work for audio professionals, and I think we're going to start to see all of this come to pass this year. So a grade of B for virtual reality. So that's my Music Tech Report Card for 2016. My guest today is Tim Latham, who's a Grammy-winning engineer, who's worked with acts like the Black Eyed Peas, Kid Rock, Lou Reed, The Roots, and Britney Spears, among many, many others. He's also mixed a fair amount of musical theater, including the really hot cast album from Hamilton, an American musical. I spoke with Tim from his studio in New York. Tim, how did you get into this business? What's your story?
The quick story was I went to Berkeley as a performance major, and my father, being a New York City cop, wanted to know where I can apply for a job to be a bass player. And the question wasn't very clear to me, and he just said, just major in something that you can at least apply for a job. So I was like, fair enough. I said, I'll major in engineering. And I was always interested in it anyway. And he had no idea what it was. He goes, whatever the hell it is, as long as you can apply for a job. And I said, yeah, you can apply for a job. And that was it, you know. And I was always the guy in the local bands anyway who had, like, the four-track and the microphones and the stuff like that. So, you know, it was just kind of like a natural fit for me.
Yeah, it's funny because it seems that all of us who are in this business who've made, you know, any kind of success, we're all that guy. That same guy, you know, you're in that band and yeah, you're the guy that follows all the electrons around.
Exactly. Chasing them around, chasing, you know, soldering cables back together and stuff like that. When the guitar, you know, when there wasn't a guitar center on every corner and you couldn't get stuff Amazon delivered to you within, you know, a half hour. So
Right. Okay.
So I was always that guy.
So you're up at Berkeley, and then I took notice that you were at Synchro Sound for a while, which is kind of near and dear to my heart. But you tell me the story about how you got over there first.
I was sitting in the classroom with the owner. I'm not sure if he still owns it. It was Richard Mendelson. It was one of my professors. And I got along very well with him. For some reason, he just like looked at me one day. It was, you know, after the class. And he just said, follow me. I was like, okay. So we walked, you know, sort of walking down the hallways and walked out of the building. And I looked, you know, and he didn't look back at me. So I kept walking down the street. And so should I keep following? He was like, follow me. So I just walked in, and we walked into Synchro Sound. He goes, you're my new intern. And it, like that, I was in Synchro Sound.
Very cool. Well, let me tell you my story.
Yeah.
I was teaching at Berkeley, and I actually put together the original music production courses and most of the recording courses and everything. I was in there very early when they were first starting the program. And at the time, Synchro Sound was Intermedia. So it was close.
Okay.
It was downtown. It was where, you know, when we wanted to record our demos in a better studio than what Berkeley had or couldn't get into Berkeley, that's where'd everybody go. And then it became Synchro Sound.
Interesting.
And the first manager is Tom Crosswaite. And it turns out that 20 years later, and I knew Tom and I met him there. 20 years later, I bump into him out here in Los Angeles. And we've become long, fast friends ever since, you know, just kind of exchanging the stories of the old Synchro days and everything. But he was the first manager, the first real manager they had in there. And it was before Richard Mendelson owned it, and right around the Cars era there, when the Cars took it over as well.
Exactly.
But I remember it well.
And it was interesting, too, because I had, you know, a few years ago, I was working on a project, and it was like a big big collaborative project, and Elliot was one of the artists on it. So, you know, we traded some stories about Synchro. He was all excited that I actually worked there and stuff like that.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, right. Cool. All right, so you're at Synchro. How did you get back to New York then? Was it because of a break that you got at Synchro?
I graduated early. Yeah, I graduated. I was also interned at, I'm sure you'll remember it because it was probably like the biggest post house there, but I also interned at Editel.
Oh, sure.
While I was in school as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I finished up school. And 11 days later, I got my first gig at a studio on 48th Street, which created the songs for karaoke machines in Japan, the sound-alikes. It was a place called RVI, and before that, it was called, I believe it was Intergalactic, and before that, it was the original Hit Factory.
Oh, yeah.
On 48th Street.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just turned out, too, that Walter Sear was in the same building.
Yeah.
So I got to cut my teeth with like, it's basically, there were no real clients. It was just session guys and engineers recreating songs for karaoke machines. Mm-hmm. And I literally, that's what I met Jimmy Douglas there. He was one of the guys that would occasionally come through, and he had worked at Atlantic.
Yeah.
So there were a few times where whatever song it was, and it's like, oh, Jimmy. And he's like, yeah. He's like, oh, yeah, I cut that. I know exactly what we did. So I got to watch him recreate exactly how some of these records that he recorded originally and redo them. So it was a really brief period. I was only there for a couple of months, but I probably learned more in those, you know, 4 or 5 months than I've done, that I did probably since then. It was such a great learning experience for me.
Wow.
Because it was all the New York session guys, like Will Lee was going through there. Everybody was just like, you know, a quick way, you know, a quick session, make a few bucks and get out of there. So, but it ran around the clock, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So,
wow. What happened then?
Yeah. And then straight to Battery, 4 days after they opened their doors.
Wow, that was a break.
Battery Studios on 25th Street, yeah. So, you know, it's a, you know, at that, for that time, it was the typical path, the intern slash gopher slash everything, because the studio had just opened. And they were owned by Zomba, which owned Jive Records and Dreamhire and Zomba, on Zomba Publishing,
yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
And so there were a lot of like records from Drive that were trickling down the stairs into us, and, you know, and fairly, like, again, fairly typical, was the intern guy. And then, you know, a few weeks into it, it's like, oh, you know, shit, there's a session. We don't have an assistant for, you're in. So was intern during the day, assist at night. And it eventually got to the point where it was full-time assisting, and, you know, the occasion would come up where there wouldn't be an engineer available. So I would be the guy. So, and I did that for close to 4 years. I was on staff there before I just went, and I've been freelance ever since.
Okay. Making the jump to freelance, that's always a big, scary move. So what pushed you over the edge?
I did the math. I just did the math. I figured if I worked half as much, I'd wind up making twice the amount of money.
That's fair enough.
You know, at the going rate, you know, at the rate, you know, basically rates that freelance engineers are making, I figured I had enough of a client base, and it's a lot easier when you're young and you don't have any responsibilities.
Yeah. True.
You know, to be perfectly honest, it was a lot easier.
Yeah.
Damn, so it was life without a net for years. And I just said, you know, I figured this is my chance. So I said my goodbyes and had a great relationship until I closed the doors, basically,
mm-hmm.
with them.
Okay, let's talk about some engineering. You have very eclectic credits. I mean, when you go from Brittany...
Yes, which scares the crap out of a lot of people, and it intrigues just as many. So it kind of works out to my, it's just about a wash.
I'm sure. But when you go from Britney to Lou Reed to the Black Eyed Peas to Hamilton, for instance, wow. I mean, and I must admit, that must be very cool for you, because you don't really get stuck in one kind of genre where you can get stale or disinterested. That must keep you on your toes.
And it was intentional. I worked very hard to make sure I was able to do that. You know, I got to the point in my career where I turned away a lot of money, basically. You know, I was just turning work down because I wanted to make sure that I had a career and not just a job.
Yeah.
So, and there were, you know, a few pivotal records there, which, you know, each one, as we know, each record leads X in some weird way. And, you know, there's a band in New York. It was a 10-piece sort of like new jazz band called the Groove Collective. Now, and Gary Katz had produced their first record. And so they're kind of like self-producing their second one on their own, but they called me to mix it. And I don't even remember what the how the connection came. It was through another record, but that record really opened quite a few doors for me.
Hmm.
You know, so it wasn't a hip-hop or an R&B record. It was whatever category. It was like, I guess, a new jazz sort of record.
Yeah.
And, you know, that opened doors. And so it was always very intentional. You know, I always wanted to make sure, because I love music. So not that I would get bored working in one genre, but I figured I really made an effort to make sure that I can work on as much as possible, different genres.
I want to talk about cast albums for a second because not many people get a chance to work on them. So I think it would be fun to, you know, really do a dive into this. The Heights
Sure.
and Hamilton, I know you've done, and they've been very successful. Did you record those as well, or did you just mix them?
In the Heights, I just mixed.
Okay.
And, you know, again, that came from another, how these, you know, sort of disparate lines kind of all come together. That record came through a producer that I worked with quite a bit called, his name is Andres Levine. And his band is Yerba Buena, and we did together, we had done a lot of like Brazilian records and Cuban records. And considering it was a, you know, it was a Latin record, they called him in to produce it and he called me in to mix it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was cut. And that was literally, that was my introduction to cast albums. I had never listened to them before. It was never, you know, it's not like something I ignored, but it just never something that crossed my bow. You know, I got the phone call and I'm just like, of course. Yeah, that sounds great. Let's, you know, let's make, you know, let's mix a cool record.
Yeah.
And, but I gained such respect for the genre because of it.
Well, it has to be done fast, first of all, because of the money involved.
That's
right?
Just it. Yeah. Well, that one we had a little bit of leeway on In the Heights, but you know, they're cut in a couple of days. You know, those records are, you know, usually recorded and, you know, the typical cast recording is a day, maybe two, that you get to record the whole thing.
Yeah.
But the Heights one, they had, you know, they were able to get some, you know, some isolation and some separation. So because they wanted it to sound a little less traditional and like a little more, you know, kind of like a contemporary record. And so they were able to record some of it. They had some isolation. So they, I think they overdubbed a lot of they overdubbed the vocals as opposed to cutting them all live.
Mm, yeah.
But then when we got to Hamilton, we actually made that as like you would make a proper record.
Huh, interesting.
It was still done at an unbelievably short amount of time, though, all things considered. So, you know, that was recorded, overdubbed, edited, mixed in 33 days.
Yeah, that is fast. Wow.
And there's 46 songs on there. There's 2 hours and 22 minutes of music. So it was basically more than one a day, and some, you know, and they would incredibly involved mixes some of them as well. So,
wow.
But that was, yeah. I mean, we probably spent, with no exaggeration, as much time in pre-production than we did recording.
Really?
And I wasn't, you know, I helped set up the recording, and I was there for the first day. But the only way that we were able to get it in on schedule was for me to start mixing the basics without anything else.
Wow.
So I left after the first day of tracking with a hard drive out, and I came out to my room and just started mixing instrumentals as they continued to finish the basics. Then they cut the orchestra, was cut over the span of a few days. And then I think they did, I'm not sure what the order was. And I had a few days to do the ensemble and a few days to do the principals as well. So as I was mixing, they would, you know, after they would finish, you know, the session, one of the recording sessions, then they would go in and start editing and comping and stuff like that to get more stuff for me together. So it was challenging to say the least because I had no vocals to work from as I'm mixing. So,
wow. Let's talk about the different way you have to approach an album like that as compared to like a normal pop album. Has to be different the way you're looking at it, right?
No, this was part of the whole discussion, like part of the pre-production. Like we wanted to, it was a kind of a very, very narrow lane that we wanted the record to land in. And that was a Broadway cast recording, but that can also be a pop record at the same time.
Mm, wow.
And so that's why we approached it as you would do a pop record. The only thing that we had everything going for us, the only thing we had going against us was the clock.
Yeah.
That was it. It was a very well-defined, I mean, Lynn took 6 years to write it.
Yeah.
And all along, Alex Lacamoire was with him working on the arrangements. So there's no question of what we needed to do. It was literally written out, you know, down to the note. It was just a matter of getting it all done on time. So, and you know, the band was incredible. The charts were amazing. Everything, all the performers too. So it made that part easier, but we approached it as you would a pop record.
Yeah.
But it had to sound, like I said, it had to sound sort of somewhere. It had to live in both worlds at the same time. And apparently we did it.
But how? How do you do that? You have to make it live in both worlds, and that's butting heads there.
It really is. No, it absolutely is. It's part of it is the nature of the just the material, what Lynn had written. He did the same thing. He figured, you know, him and Alex, you know, Lynn's writing and then Alex's arrangement orchestrations just lended itself that way. So there wasn't, what it really came down to was the overall balance between just a seesaw, like the balance between the band and the vocals, basically.
Mm-hmm.
The most traditional cast albums, you know, it's not that the music is secondary, but it's obviously it's a cast recording, so it's, you know, the importance was heavily, you know, more weighted towards the vocals than the band.
Yeah.
So we had to find that line where the vocals were present enough, but it's a hip hop record, so, you know, the drums, they had to hit hard. You know, we found this, you know, sort of narrow lane that we had discussed about, like I said, at length. It's like, we just have to really find this really, really narrow path to find and not really stray too far on either side of it, because you just stand the danger or the possibility of alienating one side or the other.
Yeah, right.
You know, like a tip, like a broad, like a cast recording, somebody who's interested in cast recordings, they might be like, oh, that sounds like a hip hop record. Or people who are into hip hop, it's like, oh, that sounds like a cast recording.
Yeah, right. Fine line. Wow. Very cool, though.
Yeah, it was narrow. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about mixing for a second. So when you get something into mix, do you listen to, and look, if you haven't worked on it previously, do you listen to the rough or do you go in cold and start a mix?
It depends. I mean, I prefer to go in cold, and some artists, it's becoming, actually, I'm hearing this more often now where the artist is just like, I've worked on this for so long, I don't want to even send you a rough mix. Do your thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, and sometimes I will. It's like, you know, like this is the idea, complete the thought for us. So, I mean, but the first thing I'll do is, you know, the ministerial work of, you know, copying files, making a backup. And I have a few different mixing templates that I'll just import if it's, you know, more of like an urban R&B or hip hop, you know, template of like plugins and reverb returns and auxiliaries and stuff like that, or like an acoustic one. So the first thing I'll do, I'll just import my mix template and then faders up and I just listen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll listen to the song 10, 15 times just to get an idea of the lyric, what the song is about. And I just let the lyrics be the guide for the whole thing.
How long does it take you to do a mix these days?
It's, this has been it was more of a internal battle that I had early on because it's just my personality. I'm an aim, focus, shoot kind of guy. But I would start to question myself. Like, wow, you did that in like XYZ takes like 3 days to get a mix. And you just did that in like, you know, 11 hours.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, oh, am I cheating them? So I would go back and, you know, and then start making things worse. So right now it's being able to work in the box has just saved so much time. You know, the rewind time, the setup time.
Recall time.
ABing equalizers, recall, you know, the endless recalls. It really depends, you know, without, you know, at least usually one a day. I try to limit myself to, you know, if I'm not sure, you know, you 99% of the time, unless I know I nailed something, I'll put it down and I'll send it off for approval or for, you know, comments and suggestions and stuff. But I'll typically, you know, I won't print anything, and then first thing in the morning, I'll wake up and listen on, you know, Fresh Ears, have a cup of coffee and just play the mix in the background and, you know, make it maybe a change or two, and then I'm done with it, and then I'm on to the next one fairly quickly.
Like the old days on a console.
Just like the old days, yep. But in a much more condensed time frame.
Yeah. Okay, here's sort of a philosophical question for you. The sound of modern mixes is considerably different than what even 10 years ago we're doing. Well, then more like 20 years, I'm thinking of.
It's even changing now, too. So,
Okay, how do you see it changing?
There are a few guys out there doing a great job, an amazing job, but I hear a lot of crap. I hear a lot of just bad mixes.
Yeah.
You know? And not just overall, but I'm just like talking internal balance-wise. I just hear very flat-sounding, very, you know, two-dimensional-sounding mixes. And that might be just I don't know. It's just because of the way people are raised and what they've listened to as growing up. So it's become kind of the way records sound. But they're, like I said, though, I'm not going to put everybody in that category. But I would say when I was cutting my teeth, I mean, guys really, really worked hard to make sure they had the absolute best sounding record. I mean, you know, I got to work underneath some super, super talented guys. And my idea was not to emulate them, but I wanted to beat what I was hearing. You know, I wanted to be George Massenburg. I wanted to be as good as George Massenburg. I love Tom Dowd's records, Bruce Sweetian. You know, I wanted to be Bruce Sweetian. Those are the guys that I aspired to be. So I don't know what younger guys are aspiring to be. I just, to be honest, you know, like I said, there are guys who are doing fantastic work. And, but with the technology at hand, I'm sometimes just disappointed in what I'm hearing.
See, I think the sound of modern mixes all has to do with, well, two things, compression, but we'll put that aside for a second, but mostly automation. The fact that you can automate so many things and you tend to do that, and I know why, but on the other hand, it comes out so slick and so homogenous as a result, and you kind of lose that.
It's danger. I always double and triple check myself to make sure, do I really need to do that? Especially now with clip gain, that has been, again, such a time saver for me, like automating vocals or, you know, a bass line where there's like one or two notes within the instrument itself that are way too loud or way too soft just because of the nature of what it is. So it's made that process, I can like level out a bass line, you know, in a matter of minutes, which would have taken me hours in the past, even just trying to automate it by hand.
Yeah.
So, but particularly with vocals, it's so dangerous to make and I think that just comes from being able to stop it yourself is from the experience and also what you grew up listening to.
That's true.
You know, I was born in 66, so it's like the record that I grew up listening to sound way different than everything in between up until this point. You know, so my sonic memory or my inner ear is just tuned to different records, I guess.
Okay, so there's a lot of engineers that we're around the same age, that are our age, that can't make the transition to, let's say, a modern sound. And there are others that can, that are in the forefront of it. So how do you do it? Because you're obviously there. I mean, everybody wants you for what you do, and you're as modern as anybody. So how did you do that?
If I'm not, like, if there's not a hard and fast deadline where I know that I have to, you know, where stuff has to be handed in, you know, but at the end of this day, X, Y, Z has to be done. I intentionally sit down and I go on to all the streaming services and I just listen to music. I spend, you know, a good part of my morning. I'm up early, you know, and, you know, I'm kind of up at like 6:30 in the morning. I have a cup of coffee. And if I don't have a mix to put down, I just listen.
Yeah.
You know, I want to, you know, I'll go to Spotify, say, and listen to the Hot 100 and just listen through, you know, a minute or so of each one just to hear what's going on. That's always a challenge for all of us is, do you start to sound dated at some point? And clearly, like, we will, and we have. So, but just to try to, you know, stay current, I guess is the best word, is I just listen.
Yeah. Okay. Makes sense.
But that's in, like we were talking about just a few minutes ago. It's some of the crap that I'm hearing. I couldn't even imagine how to make something sound so damn, just to be honest. No, I'm serious. I'm just like, how, you tried and you did this. I wouldn't even know where to start, you know, without sounding like too much of a dick, but it's, you know.
Well, here's an example of that, but from the recording side. I have a very good friend that is in the middle of recording an album of a client that you've worked with, and I'm not going to say the name, but what ended up happening was that there's different producers for every song, and he sets up his, and this is an old school guy like us. He's won a lot of Grammys, and he knows his shit. So he sets up his favorite C12 into a 1073, into a really nice LA-2A, and then the artist comes in, starts to sing, and it sounds like crap. And he's freaking out, and he's thinking, oh my God, what happened? Is the mic bad? And he starts to, you know, go through all the patch cables and everything, try to figure it out, and it seems like it's okay. And then he looks over, and the producer has a template for vocals, of which there are 5 plugins, each contradicting one another. So there's an EQ that's boosting at 5K, and another one that's cutting at 5K, and he takes those off, he bypasses them, all of a sudden the sound is back. But that was the sound they wanted. So, but it was freaking him out. Yeah. It's like, I don't know if I can continue to do this because it's just so far against my sensibilities that it's not working for me. So there you go. I mean, that's, that starts
there. I fired
there.
Myself. Yeah. I fired myself from some, from a few projects because of that. I'm like, I don't even know where to be. I wouldn't even know where to begin.
Yeah.
And I've also had, I'm not like a curmudgeon-y kind of guy. I'm a very, very, very positive person, but so especially some of like the acoustic stuff that I get.
Yeah.
It's just obvious to me that these guys didn't have any mentors.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right.
They had the money to buy the equipment was much cheaper. So the price of admission is available to just about anybody. So, and what they would tell me is like this great, amazing recording. And I have to be very, you know, be careful and precious, you know, about what I do to it because I got like this pristine sound. And I put the faders up and it's like I said, it's just like it's unimaginably bad to me.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Not bad, but it's just
not special. Yeah.
Well, it doesn't fit my ear, you know. It's like stuff that's like especially the choice of sounds. I'm just like individually they may have worked, but you know, together that's not a drum kit. That's a kick drum, a snare drum, and some cymbals and a tom-tom, but doesn't sound like a drum set.
Yeah, yeah,
but
right.
But that's where I start to question myself. Is that me aging myself, putting a time stamp on myself? So,
well, yes, but
it's a delicate line, you know?
But on the other hand, all these things cycle around. So you have to think that whatever the ears of today are, they're going to cycle around to the ears of yesterday because that'll be hip again at some point in time. We just have to have to hope that we're around when that happens.
Oh, having gone tits up by the time that comes around.
Yeah, yeah, right, right, right.
And also I think too, it's just like, you know, and it's very specific to that too. It's just like, I think it has, a lot of it, I'm convinced, has to do with monitoring. Like what are these guys, what were they listening on that this sounded good?
Yeah, right. But see, it's the whole thing of the reference point. When you have a reference point of something that you know sounds great, that never goes away from you,
yep.
And it's always something that you can work
never.
Towards. And when you grew up in the business, and I grew up in the business, we were growing up around real pros, and you could hear things that were great and then compare them to things that weren't so good. And if you don't have that
correct.
Reference
exactly.
point, it's so hard to get it.
Exactly. Exactly. That's, you know, you said it much more, you know, much more eloquently than I did over the past 10 minutes. That's exactly it. It's like the my reference point was the Nightfly.
Hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Donald Fagen's the Nightfly. I'm like, how on earth did they do that?
Yeah.
You know, Peter Gabriel Soul was actually the record that made me really just, that was the record that actually made me say, holy shit, I really want to do this. I want to learn how they made that record.
Yeah, yeah. I hear you.
You know, like you said, my reference points are completely different than somebody who is, you know, half my age. You know, I've been in studios making records probably before they were even conceived.
Yeah, yeah, I'm hearing. Yeah. Okay, a couple of technical questions for you, and then I'll let you go. I know you're in the box now, mostly. Do you have a controller that you're using?
I have, over the years, just keep streamlining. Like, as Pro Tools has gotten better, I've just gotten rid of them because I find it just slows me down.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know,
I'm good with the mouse and one fader.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm fine. I mean, I have like a 50 button mouse, whatever the hell it is, where all my editing, all the selector tools or everything like that are, you know, programmed into my mouse. So it's just like, I can look at the edit screen and poke around on my mouse and find exactly what I need to do, as opposed to, you know, paging through menus on a controller.
Yeah.
I'm right. Just too old and too impatient at this point.
How about favorite plugins? Are there plugins that you find you're using all the time? And I know we all have our favorites and lots of them. But you know, there are always like those few that no matter what, every single mix they seem to appear on. So what are those for you?
I'll just say the company, Universal Audio.
Yeah, there we go.
Because I, like you said, I have a reference point out of the box. I know what a 1081 sounds like. I know what a 1073 sounds like. I know what a Manly Massive Passive sounds like. I know what an ATR-10 sounds like, 102 sounds like. I know when I would be mixing, I would know where to hold off and where to push stuff, because I know coming off a tape, it was going to sound a little bit different.
Yeah.
So, and this one UAD started reproducing my favorite pieces of outboard gear, I just started getting rid of everything because it was indistinguishable to me. So, you know, so for like, you know, acoustic records, rock records, everything, you know, I'll have part of my mix template would be Studer A800
mm-hmm.
on almost all the tracks, going through a 1081, particularly on the drums. And then on my master fader, there's a massive passive on it,
mm-hmm.
always a massive passive. And then from there, you know, it can vary a little bit, but, depending on, you know, the song and whatnot, but, the UAD version of the GML 8200, that shows up very, very, that shows up quite a bit. The 560s show up everywhere. They just make their presence known. You know, the DBX 160 makes its presence known.
Yep.
And, there's another company, Lindell, who does some very great sort of recreations as well. They're on the, you know, through the Plugin Alliance, they do like a really, really great copy of the 2254.
Yeah,
which I've been dying, waiting for years for that. So, you know, LA2As show up, 1176s show up everywhere. But and a lot of them, you know, I'm not, and, you know, quite a bit of the wave stuff as well. But as far as like recreating, you know, stuff that I've, you know, grew up and cut my teeth on, I just go straight to UAD.
How about ambience? What are you using on ambience? Are you a big reverb guy, or do you prefer to kind of get everything through delays?
Yes.
Yes to both. Yeah, okay, right.
I mean, the honest answer is, regardless of the genre, I just let the lyric be the guide.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets a little tricky sometimes when it's like foreign language stuff, which is why I insist on either like a very loose translation. It can even just be a few adjectives. Like, is this a lonely, a sad song? Is it angry? Is it happy? Because to me, that just tells me like where the song is, who's telling the story, who they're telling it to, and kind of like where that story is being told. So I'm a big fan of dimension. So dimension can be accomplished by either delay, reverb, delayed reverb, or combinations of all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And but I'm a big fan of Altiverb.
Yeah.
Who just came out too. Relatively new was the Nimbus reverb by Exponential Audio.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Awesome.
I was just like, holy. Because you could just tailor it perfectly.
Yeah.
So, and that's what I love about working in the box too, because it's stuff that you can just, stuff that would have taken literally hours to accomplish. It's like, man, I got to really shape this reverb. All right, so now I got to across the bus before it gets into the reverb. I've got to compress this, but I got to roll off some of this stuff. I got to get it in there. But the high end is hitting it too much, so I got to de-ess it a little bit before it gets in there. But on the way out, it's not bright enough, so you got to brighten it up. And that's done now with, you know, a couple of clicks of the mouse, which I just absolutely love. Yeah, and I got all the Echo Boy stuff, too. Like, you know, I love the Echo Boy. Like, I love all that stuff. The whole effects rack, that'll show up quite a bit, too, on every mix.
Yeah, yeah. Cool.
The sound toy, all the sound toy stuff for Dimension.
Okay, Tim, last question. What is the best piece of business advice or music business advice or just music advice that maybe someone imparted to you along the way in your career, or maybe just something that you learned yourself and was kind of like an aha moment?
You really, really better be able to get along with people. I can remember assisting on sessions where the mixer was just be insufferable. And you can tell the band wasn't very happy either. And I'm trapped there at, you know, at the guy at the bottom of the totem pole. You know, the producer's not happy. The mix is cranky. And the band is kind of like sitting there. I'm just thinking, like, why would somebody spend all this money to be trapped in a room that's miserable to be around?
Yeah, so, right.
I could never figure it out. And interestingly, and totally appropriate, different career, but I met somebody on a golf course through a friend who was just introduced to me as John. It's like, yeah, my friend John is going to, him and a friend of mine who works in advertising, like we used to work in advertising together. We get on a golf course. I was like, that guy looks kind of familiar. It turns out that he is an actor. And the way that he got into acting was he's just a very dry personality. So the, one of the partners at the firm that they were working for said, John, like, you're really good at your job, but you're not great around clients. Would you be interested in taking some acting lessons to get you more comfortable around people? He said, yeah, sure. That sounds like a really good idea, actually. Fell in love with it. And at the age of basically in his early 50s, went on to have and it still has a very, very, very successful acting career. So I always thought that's like, wow, that's pretty, pretty, pretty awesome.
Yeah.
And that's something that I really learned amongst many other things, but that was from Bob Power. It was just nothing conscious. It was just his personality. He's just a very affable, lovable guy. And it's just, you just want to hang around with the guy. So I'm not saying that you should change your personality for anybody, but you really better be able to get along with a lot of different people.
Yeah.
And you have to be flexible, you know.
That's the business we're in. We're in the service business.
Yeah, you're in the service. Exactly. I don't really think it should be anybody's dream to do what we do, but it better be your passion.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah, definitely.
My dreams would probably get me arrested for, like, on moral charges and stuff like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, well, my dreams are a little bit different than, you know, but my passion is music. And I never, ever, ever let, you know, financial concerns be a motivating factor on anything I've ever done, ever.
To find out more about Tim, you can go to his website, which is protools-mixing.com. Boy, I wish I had that URL. Protools, one word, -mixing.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, you can go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or find an iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.